Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by HH Bespoke Spirits, featuring HH Bespoke Gin, Rum, and Vodka. Learn more at hhbespokespirits.com.
This week on Meet and Three, it's the final episode of our series on global trade. We're thinking futuristically, from China's ambitious plans for a new Silk Road to the future of borders and automation.
If you're a banana, you know, it's easy to cross the border. But if you're a person who's trying to follow the jobs, it's a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to do so in an authorized and safe fashion.
They love food trucks and they love growing your own food because these things are not dependent on essentially government system. So there's a whole politics to pretzels on the dark web.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm recording remotely, and today is Tuesday, February 23rd, 2021. So we've got a great group of guests today. We're going to talk about the intersection of beer and wine. Let's just go around the room. So I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host. BR?
BR Rolia, formerly of Shelton Brothers Importers, and now all-around beer person.
Great. Jake?
Jake Endres, co-owner at Crooked Run Brewing in Virginia.
And Patrick?
Hi, I'm Patrick Rue. I'm the owner and winemaker in training at Erosion.
All right. So what started this whole episode was in the winter, I was reading about the TTB had allowed different sizes of cans, and Patrick's new winery, Erosion, popped up. And I started realizing that Union Beer Distributing in New York was selling Patrick's wine in cans. And we're not going to talk about that, but it took me way back because, you know, in this little lifetime of craft beer, not even 10 years ago, Patrick Rue at the brewery in Southern California was really an icon for many of us, made some outstanding beers, and was also one of the few master cicerones in America. So to finding out that he had gone over to a winery was quite the story. So Patrick, just tell us a little bit about your winery in Napa, up in Northern California. And we're going to take this conversation to the intersection of beer and wine with the rest of our guests.
Great. Well, yeah, I started Erosion about 2 years ago. I thought there was a need for, well, craft beer is so innovative, and I love the culture and just how they're essentially isn't any rules when it comes to for a lot of craft breweries. And I wanted to kind of bring the same approach to wine, which tends to be very traditional and has a lot of rules. So we are trying to have our fun at in the wine world in Napa Valley. Our winery is located just north of Yountville, and we have a tap room in St. Helena, and we'll be making beer in St. Helena soon as well. So we're not just a winery, we're a brewery and a meadery, and we're all these fun things can collide.
And you got wine in cans too, which is always fun.
Yeah, kind of brings the craft beer touch to it, makes it a little bit more casual, and it's really nice for a single serve. You have three cans that equal 750 milliliter kind of bottle of wine, so you have three chances to open up one of our wines, which, a lot more opportunities to enjoy it.
So Patrick, just to go a little deeper, what did you learn about wine from brewing beer?
Well, we did a lot of, the brewery does a lot of beer-wine hybrids. So since I think 2009 was the first year that we brought in grapes from Santa Barbara. And every year we got a little bit better at it, essentially doing a co-fermentation with wort. And So had some really, really cool results. We did it both on the sour beer side and on kind of the big barrel-aged beer side, usually using Black Tuesday or Big Old Imperial Stout as the base. So making things that don't really fit the category of beer or wine. And I thought, you know, why not just take it a step further and actually just make wine?
Well, I'll tell you, it seems like it's more the rule than the exception now. I was just the other day up in New England. Krista Scruggs, who's a winemaker in Vermont, came out with a kind of co-ferment called a co-cellar with Shaxbury, and it was some of her grapes, but with cider. What are some other things that you're seeing that are interesting along those regards?
A few wineries in Central California area are doing essentially dry hopped pet nets. Or there's, you know, I think there's also some wineries in Oregon that are also doing dry hopped kind of aromatic white wines. So I think that's really, really promising and fun way to kind of integrate the world of beer with the world of wine. And, you know, who says that hops need to, you know, strictly be an ingredient in beer?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Now let's go to Jake. So Jake, I had you on a couple weeks ago for Crooked Run. We were talking about barrel-aged beers, but I realized that you were really into like cool ships and spontaneous fermentation and some mixed fermentations as well.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me back, Jimmy. We're doing all that, and we're also doing our first little foray into wine as well.
So what is it about your Native Culture series? Is everything based on Virginia?
Yeah, at this point, the kind of defining ethos of it is just to use everything as local as possible, but preferably within state. And at this point, we're up to all locally grown grain, fruit, and ambient yeast and bacteria. But hops are hopefully going to be coming soon. It's just that Virginia isn't really much of a hop producing state at the moment.
Yeah. And let's go back to Patrick. Patrick, so you're making wine up in Napa. Where are you getting your grapes, and how are you going about that? You know, are you doing it a little differently than most other winemakers?
Yeah, about 97% of our grapes come from Napa Valley, and then we get sourced a little bit from Sonoma. We have some pretty odd rules in Napa County that require you to use review to make your wine from 75% Napa ingredients. So we live by those rules. But the grapes here are really exceptional, so we're happy to use them. As far as our approach to winemaking, I would say we have a similar style to some of the, smaller production wineries here that make very bold, but low tannin, low astringency wines that are both, you know, approachable yet powerful. They don't age. They're not going to age 20 years, but they should be had, you know, on the, you know, within the first 10 years or so, and just really enjoyable wines. So that's kind of our approach.
That's great. And Jake, just tell us more about what you're doing, with your Naked Culture series.
Yeah. So it's just a little sub brand off of our main line of beers, but it's just all our mixed firm stuff that we've been doing. And at this point, I think we're kind of hitting our stride with it. We're doing all bottle conditioning and doing about one of these releases every month. But we're having a lot of fun with it. And it's something that we find super rewarding. It's not exactly going to, you know, pay all the bills, but it is something nice. And the main line of beers is done pretty well. So it allows us to kind of go off and get into this stuff. But lots and lots of cool ship beers, lots of stuff using local fruit. This kind of focused on Virginia terroir, which is pretty cool. We have a lot of farms growing fruit now. And then actually some of our friends opened up a farm brewery near us that grows a lot of grain. It's called Wheatland Spring. And they grow so much barley and wheat that they won't even come close to using it themselves. So they send it to a malt house in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is about 2 hours away from us. And then it's malted there, and then we have it available to make these beers with.
Well, that's great. And BR, to me, you're one of my favorite beer experts. You've been on probably more episodes of Beer Sessions Radio than anyone.
Thank you.
What's your take on this overlap of wine, beer, mixed fermentations, anything that you've seen out there that you'd like to comment on?
I mean, I think it's pretty fascinating. It really opens up the range of flavors that you can get. And, you know, while there are certainly big differences between wine and beer in terms of grapes versus grains, there's, you know, there's also a lot of overlap when you consider the yeasts that are used. You know, we worked with plenty of breweries. I mean, Cantillon, of course, started blending grapes into their beer a bunch of years back. And, you know, especially in wine growing regions, I believe he was on your show, Raphael from Trois Dames in Switzerland. He's in the Jura. So he would work with a local winemaker to make a mixed fermentation saison with both either Gamay or Chasselas grapes for the red and white varieties. But yeah, you get it's some really interesting, whether it's actually a mixed fermentation with the beer and wine, or breweries using the lees of, you know, just in terms of a barrel from a winery. I think it's great. I don't know a lot about wine. I know that I like it. I like to drink it, but I'm just intimidated by vintages and the terroir of, you know, which side and, you know, the Côte d'Or, which side of the hills are better. I just get overwhelmed by that. But I like the way it's a nice combination with beer and wine.
Yeah. Patrick, just elaborate on that and just tell us more about, you know, different grapes you're using and processes and everything.
Sure. So here in Napa, it's about the amount of the vineyard or the varietals that are planted here. It's about 70% Cabernet Sauvignon with a good chunk of Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and kind of a little bit of everything. But we try to focus on the more affordable and I don't know, I guess rare Napa varietals. So Zinfandel, Petite Syrah, you know, even Merlot seeing a resurgence after that movie Sideways screwed it up how many years ago. So essentially we're using a lot of different varietals on the red side and on the whites. We use Muscat, we use Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, and Picpoul Blanc. But some of the fun things that we are doing is using kind of non-grape ingredients in our wines. So, for example, we have a 100% Chardonnay that we use tart cherries with, so it kind of makes it this fake rosé, really nice high acid, great fruit from the cherries, kind of watermelon-like. Try to do things that are a little bit different than what's done in wine, but maybe closely mirrors what's done with beer or craft beer these days.
If you put tart cherries in your wine, I mean, can you still label it wine, or do you have to label it something else?
Yeah, so we can't say where it's made or where the grapes are from, and we can't put the varietal. So I have to say white wines with cherries, or sometimes you'll see, you know, white wine or something with natural flavors. You can use that generic term if you don't really want to say what's in the wine or what's in your beverage, but we like to put what's actually in the beverage or in our wine on the label. So yeah, you have to use those generic terms like rosé wine, white wine, red wine, that kind of thing.
So you don't have to worry about which slope on the Côte d'Or you got it from. With Bourbon.
No, yeah. Right.
So, BR brought up a good point. I mean, there's definitely a snobbishness to beer. I mean, to wine versus beer. I was thinking about that before the show, where it's kind of like people generally think that beer is lowbrow and wine is highbrow. But in the world of craft beer that we know, you know, whether it's specialty imports or you know, great brewers like you guys, I never think of it as lowbrow at all. I think the crowd is actually better, more attuned than the typical wine drinker, because I feel like most wine drinkers don't really know what they're drinking. What do you think about that, Patrick?
You know, yeah, I think the details around wine put it in this kind of snobby category and attract people that are very detail oriented, very, you know, kind of anal and perhaps snobby. And I think the same could be said for beer as well. If you have a really great story and have tons and tons of details, you're going to have consumers that are going to know every single detail and they're going to sound like super snobs to their friends. So it's all relative. But when you can pay thousands of dollars for a single bottle of wine, and an insurance company will ensure that, you know, somehow legitimize your purchase, there's something interesting going on.
Yeah. Hey, Jake, just tell us a little more backstory about Crooked Run, because you guys definitely are making your mark there in Virginia.
Yeah, thanks. So we're coming up on 8 years in business, and we started in July of 2013. I was 25 years old. My business partner was 26. And as far as I know, we were, you know, at least the youngest brewery owners in the state, but we opened up with Kickstarter money. And it was just the definition of bootstrapping. I really do not recommend anybody ever do this, but it was all we could do. And we built it slowly over time, from a barrel and a half brewery starting to 3 barrels, and then opening up a 10-barrel location, second location. And we've kind of always been doing mixed frame beers. They were a really, really hard sell at first. Nobody really knew what they were. We're doing those beers and kettle sours back in, 2014, and just people had no idea about any of it. Fruit beer was a hard sell back then too. But then that really started changing, and now sour beer is a huge part of what we do. And it's just so important to our business, because we try to cater to as wide an audience as we can, and having beer that doesn't taste like most people's idea of what beer is really helpful for that. But in addition to kettle sours, we always had this, huge passion for mixed room beers. And we've had the time and freedom, especially during a little bit of downtime over the last year, to really delve into that stuff. And that's included now winemaking, which was something that we got into for the first time last year. We were looking for another project, and we were considering a distillery. But once COVID hit, the price tag on that project was a little bit too high. So we turned to winemaking instead, with this idea that we would try to use just the existing equipment that we had and really just kind of dip our feet in it. And we made 50 cases of 6 different varieties. And I thought most of them were going to be trash. We can't call it natural wine, or we don't want to call it that, but it's low intervention. So no sulfites, 100% spontaneous fermentation using all Virginia grapes. And most of them turned out, pretty decent. So I was really stoked about that. And, we'll start releasing them over the next year and go a lot heavier into that next year. And again, sticking to this idea of offering something for everybody. If we can offer, wine and beer under one roof. And we also started doing these fruited hard seltzers, just to have something for everybody.
Yeah. Hey, Patrick, I know you have some, a good example for me of one of your wines. Which one are you making with cocoa nibs and vanilla beans?
I don't know. It's called, Secret Handshakes. It's, 98% Merlot and 2% Malbec. It's kind of, it was a really nice wine that already had some subtle notes of cacao and vanilla, primarily from the oak. And we decided to amplify that by actually adding some to it, and kind of going for this, Merlot that turned into, has the personality of an imperial stout kind of thing. So really fun. If you're like a hardcore wine, if you're the Côte d'Or, left side of the hill kind of thing, probably not going to enjoy it, or probably going to think I'm a bad person for making it. But I think a lot of people are enjoying it if you have an open mind.
So what's the mouthfeel like? I mean, is it tannic? Is it just got these different flavors?
The tannins were pretty restrained initially on it, just a little dusty. And then the cacao added a little more tannin to it, not much. So it kind of has this like cocoa powder like finish, but without drying out your mouth. So it's kind of medium bodied. Kind of feels like maybe whole milk in your mouth. So, you know, good texture, but it's not thick by any means.
You know, when you studied for the Master Cicerone, bringing back to beer, I remember the year that you were awarded that, and it was quite the story. I mean, Master Cicerones, it's still very rare and very hard to get. What are some things that you learned, you know, from your being a brewer and from your training that you applied to wine? I know I keep going back to this, but I'm trying to get you to talk more. That's why.
Totally.
You can talk about something else too. I know you're very precise, but I want you to talk a little more.
You got to get me drunk before I'm going to talk a lot, Jimmy.
You're sorry. Supposed to That's be why. Drinking.
So the Master Cicerone, I feel like, made me more precise on what, I knew a lot about beer styles going into it, but I feel like the training forces you to learn everything about each style, you know, be it from history or production methods. I think that same kind of academic rigor could be applied to wine, where, you know, there is just a lot to know in the world of wine to truly understand everything that's going on or to try to understand it. And then I think food pairings is definitely I am not well trained when it comes to putting together good pairings, or not inclined to be able to do that very well. My personal opinion is you grab whatever you want to drink, you grab whatever you want to eat, and hopefully they work out. Sometimes they are completely awful, but most of the time it'll work out just fine. But obviously you can't do that on the Master Cicerone exam. So had to learn those both conventional and unconventional pairings and what to match things up with, and that can definitely be applied to wine. And it's interesting how what the range of food pairings that you can apply to beer that there's a lot of things that don't work at all with wine, but there's always a pairing for something, even if it doesn't work out that well. So I enjoy that part about beer, is that you can always find something to pair with your meal.
I think it's much more forgiving than wine in terms of pairing. Whether it's a complimentary one or pairing, or if it's something off the wall that you can. And I find that there's a lot of, even if they're not the ideal pairing, there's a good beer pairing is way better than a mediocre wine pairing. So I just feel it tends to open up there's a lot more options with beer than there is for wine. But maybe I'm biased.
Nah, I think you're right on. Yeah. I mean, I've never had a beer with a meal that where it just truly was awful. But with wine, it was probably a few weeks ago, I had one of our really, really heavy red wines, and I was making spaghetti and meatballs, and, you know, I was so proud of this meatballs and spaghetti. And then I have it with the wine, and it's just like, it made the wine taste like super flabby and just like had no flavor at all. And then you come back to the pasta, and the wine made the pasta overly acidic and unbalanced. You know, where if I knew my stuff and picked a higher acid red wine, that things would have been much better.
Well, it's like the old wine salesman knew that they would, if they tasted you with wine, if you had a little piece of cheese with it, you would buy the wine. They say totally. Sell with cheese. And what about at the St. Helena? So at your tasting room, I try to picture, like, I know where Jake is because he was on, he's in Virginia, not too far from DC, but St. Helena is up in Napa Valley. I know that's north of San Francisco, but what's your tasting room like? And in terms of food pairings, you know, what have you been serving that goes with wine?
Yeah, we are, well, the town of St. Helena is about 6,000 people, very small, but, if you're traveling through, there's a lot of tourism in this area, so you pretty much have to drive your car through it to get anywhere. So we're right on that kind of main drag, and it is we have 24 of our wines on tap. We focus on the draft menu. Really want to have things that are, you know, we can just do a 5-gallon blend and see what people like before we package a large amount of anything. So we try to get a lot of people's opinions before we put anything into a can. My wife and we picked a designer, and it's really cool. You know, just the feel of the place actually makes people want to drink white wine. So I saw a ton of white wine, even though I specialize in red wine. And just feels very, you know, we play 80s music and it just feels like, you know, you just need to be down in spritzy white wine, which is fine to me. And as far as, you know, food pairings, we're kind of expanding into twice the space and adding a beer bar, you know, or a tap room for the brewery there. So we're actually going to be doing dips of all things. Just think, you know, if you're going to do a Super Bowl party or you're going to, you know, if you're going to any party, really, a dip is always, you know, highly appreciated. So how can we basically add a food menu item that, you know, will, I guess, work for those in between sort of meals? And, you know, Napa Valley, there's, you know, many Michelin star restaurants. I'm not going to compete on a restaurant basis, but I can offer something quirky with our weird wines and beers that that people will enjoy.
So what's a pairing that would go well? So with a dip, what will go well with the wine and beer? Is there a particular dip or flavor?
Wow, that's a good question. So I do want to make like a it's kind of buffalo. I don't know, imagine buffalo chicken, but instead with brisket. And I think pairing that with the big Syrah, you know, it's a little smoky and tobacco forward and a lot of ripe, you know, plum, dark berry sort of flavors. I think, you know, with that and let's say an Imperial Porter or really just a darker beer that does have some roast backbone and kind of big mouthfeel, I think those kind of things would, you know, pair nicely together. But more trying to make things that are just generally appealing, you know, kind of fit my mindset on food pairing as, yeah, you can just pick anything on the menu. It's good. It'll taste good.
Yeah. And what about the culture? So you're going to have a brewery as well as the winery, for your staff, like the serving staff, is there going to be like a conflict where are there certain staff that are going to be more into the wine than into the beer or do you see it as that it'll appeal to all guests?
Yeah, I think the locals are, so most of the people who live in the area are in the wine industry. And as much as they love wine, they're kind of tired of it at the end of the day. So a nice beer usually fits the fits the bill. So we're actually making the beer more for the locals. But I think people who know me on the beer side will, you know, hopefully be excited about it too and come check it out, you know, even if they don't love wine. Then I think from a tourism perspective, we, you know, offer a lot of cool Napa Valley wines, but we're also offering, you know, that highly desired beer after you've been drinking like big old cabs all day. It's nice at 4:30 to roll in and have like a 4.5% Czech Pilsner, Czech style Pilsner or something like that. So trying to make it, you know, wines that are super refreshing and good for that. I'm already drunk on red wine. I still want to drink sort of beer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I remember for a lot of the Cider Week events in New York, after the day of tasting hard cider, all those cider men would want to drink IPAs with me. So there's something there, man. People do like beer, you know? And we're going to keep talking more about that. I just want to get back to Jake. So Jake, also a little more about Crooked Run and the food that you guys are serving there.
Yeah. So, we have, two restaurants at our larger location. We have a taqueria called Señor Ramon and a, chicken and biscuit, brunch restaurant called Daybreak. And when we first opened our second location, we had one restaurant that we were selling to, was this taqueria, and they were like pretty much the only place that got our beer and distro. And we asked their owner if he wanted to sublease some space in our new location and open up his restaurant there. And it turned out to be like the best business decision that I've ever made. Because quite honestly, like even if our beer was not all that great, just having the taco shop there made it an instant hit from day one. There's good crowds there. And It's tough running a restaurant, as I learned when we then worked with the same owner to open up the brunch restaurant, which is really cool, but I'd never run a restaurant before and it's a lot of work. And there's a reason why, you know, so many people either don't want to get into it or look to outsource it now. But both are doing really well, especially all things considered. And it's great to have food. I mean, like, it's so nice that we don't have a lot of the problems that some other breweries have with just people getting sloshed. The food really helps cut down on that a lot. And it just, it makes it more, you know, friendly to families and people's friends that aren't as into beer or whatever. Super helpful. And tacos and beer, I mean, that's just a kind of hit for everybody. And then the brunch side has cocktails and wine too. So the whole thing just kind of works all together.
Yeah. Food and drink are really important for me. That's always my jam. And BR, you know, for me, you really are one of my favorite beer people, and I respect your opinion on most things. I'm going to ask you, pick a favorite drink and food pairing that others could learn from.
Oh, wow. That really puts me on the spot. I mean, it's kind of like whatever I'm eating and drinking at a given time, maybe. I don't know. It's that's... Can you get back to me on that one?
Yeah, that's I think we're going to stir the pot a little bit in this show. So
yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, beer and cheese, you can't go wrong with that. You know, but there was, you know, there was something I had recently. I'm trying to remember what it was, but it was one of those like aha moments that I wasn't expecting. And let me see if I can remember that, and I'll get back to you.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by HH Bespoke Spirits. The award-winning and critically acclaimed Tailored Spirit Collection features HH Bespoke Gin, Rum, and Vodka. The Black-owned Fashionable Portfolio is a lifestyle brand extension to fashion and retail companies 5001 Flavors and Harlem Haberdashery. HH Bespoke Spirits is available for sale and to ship nationwide. Learn more at hhbespokespirits.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Become a member and support us at heritageradionetwork.org. So we're talking at the intersection wine and beer. Really, we're talking with Patrick Rue, who's at Erosion Wine up in Napa, and Jake Enres at Crooked Run in Virginia with BR Roya, our beer expert. So let's back to that. BR was asking about a favorite drink and food pairing. I'll say mine. It's I've said it before a million times. Garrett Oliver's Brewmaster Table Stilton, which is a great blue cheese with a barley wine. So that's something that I can always go to and say. But sometimes I just want like a really good like canned tuna, conservas tuna, you know, with a simple wine or a simple beer. I kind of agree with what Patrick was saying. I don't necessarily, sometimes I feel like that food and wine just go together or food and beer just go together anyways. BR?
No, I agree that, I mean, with a Stilton for me though, I would go more, I personally like, let's say, an Imperial Stout, where you get a little bit of the roasted malt as well as some of the chocolate notes. Sometimes I find, I mean, I guess it depends on if it's an American or British style barley wine. I find that the malt can be a little bit too sweet with a blue cheese, but I love blue cheese so much that I will happily eat it with any beer or wine pairing.
Yeah, no, it's a winner. And then BR, you know, in your work with like especially Belgian and French breweries, do they typically have food at the tasting rooms, or is that something then you go on to a restaurant separately?
No, that, I mean, I think perhaps some of the newer breweries are getting into that. Traditionally, you know, a lot of the older breweries, tasting rooms weren't even really a thing like they are in the U.S. Like, you know, they might only be open limited hours, or they were originally somewhere where you would simply go to pick up bottles. More and more, they are getting into the idea of having it as a destination where people can sit and hang out. Daronka, for example, has built a new tasting room, and they work with a chef and do some really, you know, nice simple pairings, whether it's cheese and charcuterie or some small plates. I think it's becoming more common now. But initially it was more you would go out or, you know, in Belgium in particular, in northern France, you have the cuisine à la bière, where restaurants will make specific dishes with, I mean, it's popular in Brussels, particularly beers or dishes with local beers to be served, you know, in food cooked with the beer and then served with, you know, an additional, the beer on the side to complement it.
Is there a question for Patrick that you'd like me to ask?
Yeah, I'd be just curious to see what his take is of how he finds the difference between moving from brewing beer to moving into the wine world. Was if it was a big jump or if it was just more of an easier transition given the brewing background?
Oh, yeah. So at first it was extremely exciting, but I thought, it sounds terrible, but I thought people would know me more in the wine world than they do. Nobody knows who the hell I am in Napa, which is kind of cool. I have an opportunity to do something completely different and not be tied to whatever I was making previously at the brewery. But at the same time, my ego has been just has shrunk a little bit, which is probably a good thing as well. But yeah, I think people are enjoying the fact that beer is coming and that we can bring a little touch of that to Erosion. So I think the beer side is very welcome. I think our approach to wine, taking kind of that craft beer approach to wine, is seen a little bit with, you know, a little bit of a not quite as welcoming, but still having a lot of fun.
Yeah. And let's go to the new thing. So there's a lot of excitement going on. So I was talking to you a couple weeks ago about wine in cans and the TTB. And then you said that you'd be opening the brewery and also making mead.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff happening lately. Yeah, with that TTB thing. So basically we were only able to, well, in the U.S. you can only sell wine with certain bottle or container sizes. So things like 375 milliliters, 500, 750 milliliters, you know, normal size bottle, those things are allowed. Things like 250 milliliter cans that we sell our wine in, we're not allowed. So basically we would have to package either as a 2-pack, 3-pack or 4-pack of the same wine to be able to sell it kind of as an aggregate of an approved size. So it has to be packaged together and sold together. So by allowing that 250 milliliter size, we're able to sell cans individually. And probably what I'm most excited about is selling them as variety packs. So, you know, you're able to buy something that's the same price as one of our bottles of wine, but you get three different wines in there. And I think of all the cool kind of pairing opportunities that come from that, both at home and for restaurants that perhaps don't really specialize in wine, but they can buy, you know, a small amount of our wine and kind of have all their bases covered. So pretty fun.
Yeah, man. That sounds cool. I'm going to go back to Jake. So Jake, just tell us a little more about what some of the things you're doing with your cool ship and spontaneous fermentation. You were talking about natural wine. Are you working with natural wine or what do you call it? You call it something else, don't you?
Yeah. So I'm still really new to this, but from my understanding, there's not really a legal definition for natural wine, but it's a term that's thrown around a lot. And I think it's kind of gotten a bad rap just because it's maybe a little bit disingenuously used for marketing purposes sometimes. But basically it's wine that's made with organic hand-picked grapes, naturally fermented with no added yeast and no added sulfites. There's not a lot of organic grapes that are being grown in Virginia. They're just too susceptible to black rot. And we wanted to work with what was available locally. So we're just kind of referring to it as low intervention wine. Basically all of that, you know, no yeast added, no sulfites, but using the grapes that we have access to. It is a little bit similar to also brewing with a cool ship in that you are capturing the native yeast and bacteria that are, you know, in the surrounding area, but it's a lot, I'm going to say, easier. This yeast loves to live on the skin of grapes. So if you just go with what's on the grapes, you already have a lot of active yeast and fermentation takes off pretty quickly versus cool ship beers where you cool them overnight. You have yeast and bacteria from the air that falls into the beer, and you usually don't start to see any visible signs of fermentation for several days afterwards. So it's never going to be quite as robust, but they are kind of similar in concept.
Yeah. And Jake, I have one of your beers that's very wine-like, the Drupale, the Golden Sour with raspberries, Framboise Lambic inspired, spontaneously fermented, cool ship sour ale.
Oh, awesome. I'm so glad those made it to you. I was worried about that. Drupale's a cool beer. Lambic is a protected regional term, like Parmesan or Champagne. So we can't use that, but these are Lambic inspired beers. They're made with, there's something called Method Traditionnel, which is this set of guidelines that was developed for U.S. brewers to use. It basically means that it adheres to all the guidelines that Belgian Lambic producers follow. So turbid mash, raw wheat, aged hops, barrel fermented, and cool ship inoculated. But that beer Drupale was made with all the methods that Framboise style beer might be made with, and using all Virginia malt and all Virginia raspberries. And that was our first Lambic inspired beer that we released. We released it right before Christmas, and I just really like it a lot. Its flavor is very much like a melted raspberry Dole popsicle. We're super stoked with the way that turned out.
Yeah. Hey, back to BR, talking about sour beers. We always talk about language. I love the language that you use. He was just talking about popsicle flavors. And how do you see the kind of the evolution of language that people are using to describe flavors in beer? Because we used to joke about, you would say, like, from what was Barnyard Nose, you said was horse blanket. But
no.
It seems like this whole generation is talking about popsicles. And
no, my thing was that there is no horse blanket in beer. That's my major pet peeve, having been around a lot of horse blankets. I think it's great because, and I think this is, you know, kind of going back to your earlier question of is wine snobbier than beer, I find that in wine, it sometimes there tends to be a very rigid vocabulary for describing beer. Obviously, it's loosened up a bit now. I mean, from what I've noticed, it seems though that beer people are more inclined to simply pull out what they taste or what they smell in a beer, regardless of it's, you know, whether it's a phenol or an ester, in terms of, you know, are you going to pull out a specific fruit? And some people, you know, depending on their palates and their culinary backgrounds. I remember we used to do the Ale Street News panels over at Waterfront Ale House, and the chef would come out sometimes to join us, and he would pull out these descriptors just from his culinary background, where you're like, oh, wow, yeah, I didn't even occur to me. That's exactly what that aroma or that flavor is. So I think, you know, it's great for beer to be able, if it's popsicle, it's a popsicle. You know, if it's an olive, it's an olive. I judged at a homebrew contest once where the overwhelming flavor was definitely Captain Crunch cereal. You know, it was. So I think just whatever works for you and how you're able to describe it is fine. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer in terms of what you personally perceive in a beer or wine or other, you know, food or beverage.
But like for years, whenever I studied wine or beer, you kind of end up depending, or you used to depend on certain catchphrases, which is like why people say barnyard or grapefruit for like a Sauvignon Blanc. But for me, when I hear Jolly Rancher, I just don't know what Jolly Rancher is. I'm serious. Like, what's the flavor of Jolly Rancher or nose when someone says that's in a beer?
For me, I guess it's candy-like. I haven't had a lot of experience with Jolly Ranchers either.
They're talking about like just that fake apple candy flavor.
Okay. Yeah, which makes, yeah, that makes sense. But
Jake, what? Oh, go, Bjorn.
Oh, no. I was just saying, you know, a lot of people, you know, they might not necessarily fall back on descriptors. They just might not even think to, they could go, move ahead of it's, you know, it's it's a dark fruit. Well, is it a blackberry? Is it a plum? Is, you know, you can, I think people need to trust their themselves and say, well, this, and understand that it's not wrong if they say, I get blackberry, and someone else says, no, I get raspberry or boysenberry. You know, just say what you find in a beer, whether it's Jolly Rancher or
what you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Jake, you jumped in on Jolly Rancher. What are some other words that people use when they're tasting your beers?
Yeah. So I don't know so much about other people because like I used to do all the bartending and it was a weird situation where like normally the chef at a restaurant doesn't like serve the food to the customer and then hang out with them at the table. So I did get to be privy to like a lot of comments on our beer, which was sometimes great, other times not so great. But the ones I use a lot that I find myself coming back to over and over are I use jammy to describe Brettanomyces driven fruit flavor in beers, which is something we really go for a lot. So Brett flavor can get that kind of, you know, funky, like quote unquote horse blanket or sorry, beer, like whatever people like to refer to it as, it can get that, but that's usually when it's stressed out. Brettanomyces yeast is really weird and has a lot of interesting properties, but when it's healthy and ferments properly, it can really add this very fruity flavor, which can be kind of raspberry jam / overripe pineapple. And that's really what we go for in a lot of our beers. The other one that I find myself using like way too much is gunpowdery minerality. And I grew up in a town that had a lot of annual Civil War reenactments. And so like black powder in the air, like that really reminds me of like the taste I get out of some Spahn beers and lambic beers. But whatever, what I'm trying to say about beer, whatever you're trying to say, yes, of course, like if it's just you as a person talking about beer, say whatever you feel. But if you're trying to talk to customers, just try to keep it to stuff that people actually understand. You know, if you're going all, you know, Paul Giamatti and sideways on what you're tasting and people aren't getting it, they're just going to feel either confused or they're going to try to search for it, even if they're not really tasting it. So just keep it simple.
That's a good point. So Patrick, what are some descriptors that people are using in Napa, you know, when they're tasting or smelling your wines, or terms that you like to use? Like we had mentioned Jolly Rancher, we'd mentioned jammy, you mentioned black gunpowder.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're more along those lines of how we describe our wines is kind of what we're used to in craft beer. And as it smells like what, you know, what you associate this thing with. I feel like things in wine are much more like prescribed, like, you know, blue fruit, red fruit are very generic ways of saying like, I don't know if it's a cranberry or if it's a, you know, a raspberry, somewhere along those lines, or I don't know if it's a blackberry or just smell, it smells darker. It smells less, you know, less acid forward. I think the most interesting ones are when it's kind of about the texture or it's kind of like lingering mouthfeel that you get, minerality. We don't tend to suck on rocks. But it might seem like you like to enjoy having rocks in your mouth when you say that this tastes like graphite, or you know, I taste the quartz in this, or you know, crap like that. So, but I do think that there is the kind of those minerality impressions. I don't think that we have good vocabulary for whatever it is. If that makes any sense.
Yes, and it's one thing that BR and I have talked about for years back and forth is this vocabulary of tasting. Which I feel like we're still just figuring out. So like some of your wine, the Secret Handshake, you know, so there's added ingredients, but when you're tasting it, like in your nose and the mouthfeel, how does that come across? Do the cocoa nibs and vanilla jump out at you or other things that you're tasting and smelling?
Yeah, I think the initial impression is you get kind of like dark cherry with maybe some blueberry and then like, you know, covered in chocolate. And then the mid palate, some of the almost like a coffee-like character starts to develop. And then as it finishes into that kind of sweet vanilla that just has a really long sort of impression on your palate, and then kind of finished off with dustier, kind of chocolatey tannins. Something that you might, if you had like a candy that's rolled in cocoa powder, kind of that feeling on your, that stays on your palate after you're done with that candy. I don't know. How does that work for you, Jimmy?
Oh, that's good. Now you're getting me. The next question is, Patrick, do you taste differently when you're tasting wine than beer, for what you're looking for? Or are you still tasting the same way with all your senses?
Yeah. I think it really depends on the style of wine. Well, on the style of wine and the style of beer. I think, say, for a red wine, you're looking for the wine to hit you in multiple places over time. So you're looking at, in the first like half second, what am I getting? How big is this? Is it super acid and, kind of hurts my palate, or is it smooth and kind of go into this mid palate? Is there, a lot of flavor? Is there a change of flavor that happens, a half second later? And then as you swallow it, what does the texture feel like as it's rolling, in the back of your mouth? Which I think, gives a big impression on flavor, even though it's just texture. And then going into a finish, when I'm done swallowing, for how long am I still tasting that? And does the flavor change? So I think, I think a good red wine, you want to see, you always want to see it be pleasant, but it's fun if, the flavors kind of change and if there's that, kind of beginning, middle, and end to it. As far as if you're drinking a Pilsner, I'm looking for something pretty different. You're looking for a crisp mouthfeel, something that really, that you're not getting a huge lingering aftertaste. Maybe it's a little grassy, but you don't want a huge lingering aftertaste when it comes to something that's refreshing. So maybe like a Pilsner might be similar to how you might judge a sparkling white. That makes sense, with their kind of refreshment factor being the main goal of it.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Let's jump to some of your new projects. So mead, tell us about the mead that you're making and why you're going in that direction. I know that some retail friends say that the fans of good craft mead are the most particular about transparency of sourcing, for example. Mm. So you may be in the most diehard group of fans with mead.
Yeah, definitely. I think as interest in barrel aged beers has grown, I think there's also been an increasing interest in mead. I feel like the two connect pretty well on a flavor perspective and attract kind of the same sort of person. So I became interested in a while ago. But never, if at the brewery would have to create a winery, and it was always kind of prohibitive to go that direction, or maybe just not worth our time at that particular time. But now that I do have a winery, and I have a little bit, I have a few extra tanks I can use. There's really that in winemaking. There's a lot of tanks sitting for 9 months out of the year doing nothing. What can we do with those? So it's a bit of, a little bit of making the most out of what we have, and kind of entering a new category where I get to experiment more. So these initial meads that we're making kind of don't fit that big beer style, or that, big mead, fruited mead style. We're looking for a way to make like a refreshing below 7% sparkling mead that incorporates high acid, primarily white wine, but looking at also like doing a piquette kind of red wine sort of mead combo. So a lot of fun stuff that we can be doing.
So your meads are you're using grapes as well as honey,
right? So we can right now, right this second, we are just about to add yeast to so it's about nine Plato, nine bricks, so it's going to produce right under 5% alcohol. We're going to let that ferment out, and then we will try 10%, 20%, 30%, try different ratios of different wines and see kind of what goes together. And it's pretty cool. We're using the yeast that we're using. We're going to get a lot of flavor from the yeast. We're using Berkeley yeast, which uses genetically engineered, essentially changing kind of the flavor profile of the fermentation. So super excited about what we're going to, how that'll evolve.
Well, Patrick, you know, this is pretty cool getting you on. I'm still, you know, you were, you know, a big name in brewing. You were a master of Cicerone, and now you're kind of going a little incognito. I was joking that you're in the dark web now. It sounds like you're coming out the other side, and you're going to have some really cool things going on. So thank you so much, man. I'm going to go back to Jake. Jake, we were talking about, you know, flavors and descriptors. What I'm impressed with you is that you can really talk about all areas of brewing. Are you self-taught just from having your own place, or what are some of your biggest influences on your learning about?
Yeah, I'm self-taught. I think higher education beer is really great. It's not something that I had the opportunity to do. And those opportunities expanded a lot over the last 7 years. But you know, back when I started, it was pretty much UC Davis and Durman's and a couple other places offering brewing courses. Now the way I get information is just talking to colleagues like nonstop. And I've been pretty bored during the pandemic. So I like having phone calls with people we've brewed with, and we talk about just, you know, stuff we're working on, stuff that's cool, you know, the direction we see the industry going in. But yeah, the wine stuff we're doing is, you know, just again, kind of a product of like, hey, we've got time on our hands and let's do something and make some moves to move us forward and see where it goes.
Wow. It's great. It's great getting to know you, man. Thank you so much. Crooked Run in Virginia, and back to BR, just so everyone knows your cred. I mean, we know you as an import rep, but, just tell us some of the, you've been a beer judge. Just tell us some of your credentials. Cause again, to me, you're one of my top beer people.
Yeah, no, I mean, been drinking beer for a long time. Helped to live in Europe when I was younger, so there was no drinking age. But yeah, started out, my beer education mostly started as a home brewer, then went into the beer judge certification program, nationally ranked beer judge for at least over 15 years now. And yeah, just kind of continued. I haven't done the Cicerone program, but you know, I still definitely do a lot of reading and love to learn from the brewers I've worked with, whether it's, you know, talking with them or visiting their breweries and learning more about their process and, you know, on their systems, just to try and increase my knowledge, and even just general beer tourism. Back in the day, used to take a little Michael Jackson pocket guide to Europe when I would go there for a previous job for work, and just go around and check out all the places and all the classics that he described, to try and learn more. But always trying to keep learning on this too.
Well, you're great. I'm going to just thank everyone for joining me, and appreciate that we've been overcoming technology. For 10 years, we were in a studio in Brooklyn, and now for almost the last year, we've been recording remotely. And big thank you to Patrick Rue. He's in Napa Valley, California, of Erosion Buzz. Right, Patrick? It's Erosion Wine and soon-to-be brewing and meadery.
That's right.
Jake Endres at Crooked River. Crooked Run in Virginia, just outside of D.C., and this is the second time on in a month. It's great getting to know you as well. And B.R. Roy, our good friend in Brooklyn. We usually wouldn't get to be talking to either of you, Patrick or Jake, unless you're in the city. So we've definitely been able to expand our reach with these platforms. And I just miss raising a glass of beer with you. So if I could right now, I'd have some of that Erosion secret handshake, Patrick. But I think I'm gonna really ante up and wait for that your new meads that have some grapes and honey in them. And I know what you're doing is really cool. And Jake, also, we've talked about barrel-aged beers and your spontaneous fermented cool ship stuff. So really, thank you so much. And Everybody, thank you, Caroline Fox, our producing intern, Armin Spingen, our engineer. Thanks for joining me on Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, guys. Thank you. Woo!
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
For listening.